the conversation. It's episode 167 with John Walter. He is a London-based artist, PhD candidate, writer, performer, video maker, etc. As this comes out, I imagine he will have his doctorate. He will be Dr. John Walter, Dr. John for short, no doubt. And I am Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com. Please go there. Check out the feast for your eyes that is John Walter's work, including his Alien Sex Club, his Tandoori Cottage, the name for the flat that he lived in for 5 years, that is ultra-colored, multicolored, where he lived and worked. So we talk about that. Go check it out, among other images related to his PhD and beyond. And yeah, this is the second London artist that I spoke to. And funnily enough, don't you love it when people use the word funnily? We actually chatted while he was in New York. He was doing a U.S. trip, L.A., Las Vegas, and New York. And just because of the relatively close time difference when he was in New York, we found that the best time to connect for an hour or so. And now he's back in London. Second being after Sherman Sam from a while back, a great guest, as you may recall. If you haven't heard, go listen to that. And yeah, so we are invading Europe as we speak, Brexit regardless. What else do I have to tell you? Yeah, this is the Thanksgiving Eve as I record this. I want to get this out to you over the Thanksgiving weekend so you can have something to listen to and so we can remain steady on the ship. And it is dead quiet outside. It was just utter madness last night and today and this afternoon on the road. And now everybody seems to be tucked into their chimneys, boarding up for the coming apocalypse and so on. You keep hearing that story, so I will not retell it beyond that. On the back end, no bad advice. It's probably going to have to wait until next episode, but do stay tuned for some other material and announcements and whatnot. And in the meantime, please enjoy my conversation with John Walter. Thank you very much for listening. I will talk to you on the back end. So you're in New York.
I am, and it's been the most beautiful day. It's really sunny.
Fantastic.
It's quite hot. Yeah.
Wow. It sounds kind of like here. How hot would you say? I mean, I guess you're
God,
in Celsius, right?
I don't even know in Fahrenheit. I still don't understand that.
Sure.
It was like a September day.
Oh, okay.
November. So yeah, it was definitely t-shirt weather.
Does it make you feel both lucky to enjoy that kind of weather and also worried for our future at the same time?
In so many ways. Yeah. I'll enjoy it while it lasts.
Right. Right. Are you out in Queens now? That, if I remember right, that's where you're staying?
Brooklyn, yeah, Greenpoint in Brooklyn.
Oh, Greenpoint.
Yeah.
Greenpoint, got it. Okay. And you are not a first-timer to the States, because I know from looking around your activity that you were in Skowhegan, but I imagine you've been elsewhere as well.
Yeah, my relationship with America started with dating an American when I was at graduate school and then living here for a little while. And then coming back to do Skowhegan in 2012. So, yeah, I have this funny, it's like an on-off relationship with it.
Right. So you were in grad school in the UK and you met an American and you guys...
Yeah, all my education was in the UK.
Right. And so did you come over with the boyfriend?
The boyfriend, yeah. I had this fantasy that I was going to live here. I think like a lot of English people, you think, I'm going to move to America. I'm going to become American. And then I got here. I didn't really have any way into it. I didn't really have the right connections and I hadn't done grad school here. So it wasn't working financially emotionally.
Right.
So that ended up not happening.
But right.
It was fun. It was good. And it was good to understand a bit about how New York works and what America is rather than being outside looking in.
Yeah. There are quite a number of expat British in Los Angeles. I'm not sure how large compared to other parts of the country, but it seems like a pretty large number. And obviously they're drawn by the weather. You know, I'm not sure, maybe the music business as well. But what was the fantasy being in the UK that you wanted to go to the States?
For me, it's always been this obsession with 1980s New York painting.
Oh, no kidding.
People like Julian Schnabel and Basquiat and David Sally.
Right.
Huge heroes of mine.
Wow.
So it's just about being close to that in a way. Yeah.
That was kind of the sort of the era of stardom that brought me to New York from the West Coast originally.
Okay.
Actually, it was like, you know, the glamour of the late 80s, basically. And, you know, you had to go to New York to become Basquiat, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. And then you get there and you can't come here.
Right. And also, but in addition to that, before we get off these names, I had a very ambivalent relationship at best with Schnabel. And I've come I've kind of come to hate him. I don't know if the climate for you has changed. You still love him?
Yeah. I think, I mean, he's probably a complete nightmare as a human being.
Right.
I absolutely adore the work. Mm. And I think he's done something that's not fully been appreciated.
Wow.
I would defend him. I saw an extraordinary exhibition he did at the Palazzo di Venezia in Rome about 6 years ago, and it was mind-blowing. I mean, it was really an amazing thing.
Hmm.
But yeah, he's a contentious character.
Right. And do you feel his film body has changed your appreciation of his artwork, or not had an effect on it?
I don't really see them in relation to each other. I mean, I think what he's done for painting is quite massive in terms of he's opened up new vistas of possibility, certainly for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I enjoyed Basquiat. I don't really need to watch it again. I enjoyed Before Night Falls. I don't really need to watch it again.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not saying he's my biggest hero or something.
Right.
But I think the velvet stuff and the stuff on plates is amazing.
But you are kind of outing yourself, though, as a bit of a fan of neo-expressionism and a certain aesthetic, which is unusual these days.
Yeah, well, I suppose it fits in my interest in visual awkwardness.
Mm, okay.
And also my perverse sense of liking things that other people might not be interested in.
Right.
Isn't contrived, just ends up happening that way.
Right.
I'm like, oh, I like that. Oh, you don't like it. Oh, okay. so he fits in with that.
What about, you know, but thinking back on your attraction to the New York late 80s art scene, what about, though, all those potential heroes in London, you know, the whole crowd of Freud and Bacon and Auerbach and so on? I mean, was there any lure there, or how did you see them?
It kind of happened. They were my first love. So as a teenager, I think this is probably quite common, I became a big fan of Auerbach and Kossoff and Kitaj. And Freud, and I thought Freud was, you know, I couldn't understand how those paintings were made. And now I look at them and I think they're terrible. I just saw a big exhibition of them when I was in LA at the Getty.
Yeah, London Calling. I saw it too. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's terrible. The Bacon stuff's okay, but the majority of it, you could just throw it in the bin. But I think it's teenage art. It's all about painting thickly and bad drawing. And
Wait a second. What you just talked about could describe the majority of neo-expressionist painting.
Different types of badness, I suppose.
Yeah.
There's something so labored about that. I mean, Kitaj is different, but and Kossoff's not as bad. Auerbach's the lowest one for me. There's just an earnestness around that idea of draftsmanship. That is really desirable when you're a young person,
right?
That you realize is actually just rhetorical and false a bit later on.
Huh. Okay.
Schnabel does things quickly and flamboyantly, and they either work or they don't. And if they don't work, he throws them away.
Right.
Whereas Auerbach would just belabor it until it's really bad.
But what about the paradigm, for lack of a better word, of the sort of macho painter, you know, who, you know, even it you can use even Joan Mitchell as an example, because there's this sort of classic cartoon of her staring at the canvas in the middle, in the first panel. In the middle panel, she's like, you know, brushing across it. And then the third panel, she's sitting and smoking and looking at her painting. You know, it's you could say the same thing, though, more severely about, you know, especially Schnabel, because there are those images of him, you know, standing on a ladder, looking down at his big tarpaulin on the beach, you know, and that kind of thing. I mean, that's hard not to be driven crazy by.
But I think that it's, I can disassociate certain things. I agree. I think that the predominance of the artist biography and the stardom factor are problematic. But there is something still in the work that's interesting. What's the word I'm looking for? Formally, but also in terms of content. But yeah, I mean, I've fought against all those things in how I present myself as an artist. Mm-hmm. So it's not that I'm an advocate of that kind of, I don't know what you'd call it. It's like Jeffrey Deitch rising people up and proclaiming them, isn't it? It's that whole culture. No, that's a horrible diversion, but it is a thing. It's a, you know, it does happen.
Yeah.
We can't ignore it.
Without getting into the details at the moment, obviously a lot of your work has been AIDS related. And so I wonder, in that light, talking about 80s artists, you know, if Keith Haring, you know, was important to you in this context, or, you know, it sounds like based on the things that you like, it was maybe kind of a different genre.
Yeah. So I suppose the project you're referring to, Alien Sex Club, was to do with HIV. So I would also without wanting to be a pedant, distinguish it against AIDS, because it was trying to look at a difference in time between the 80s and now.
Right.
But yeah, I suppose that's what I've become quite well known for recently, is this project Alien Sex Club.
Yeah.
That Haring does interest me, and it's partly because of the generosity of what he does for viewers. There's a fun element and there's humor, and that is a way of seducing people that I think is really interesting.
Mm. Since we're on the subject of Alien Sex Club, and for better or for worse, it's one thing that you're known for. Considering the audio context, can you give listeners, you know, a good sort of image to put into their head about what that was like?
So Alien Sex Club was a big installation that happened in 2015 in London and Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also a PhD that I've written, which looked at how representations of HIV AIDS within visual art could be innovated using maximalism,
mm-hmm.
which is a debatable word,
mm-hmm.
and spatial designs. So it was also looking at what curating was versus what is architecture within staging an exhibition. And it was a big kind of carnivalesque that involved painting, performance, video, song, inflatables, but importantly three live elements: a bar, so hospitality,
mm-hmm.
tarot reading,
mm-hmm.
so fortune telling, and free rapid HIV testing. And these three things animated it and helped audiences engage in different ways in things.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good short description.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And was the context or the venue that you used such that you were going to get street traffic that would be in need of HIV testing?
So it was what was interesting, throwing the HIV testing in, we weren't sure whether anybody would do it and whether it would jar with my very playful aesthetic. But we did the testing in a garden shed that I had customized. So it changed the appearance. It wasn't a clinical environment. And it wasn't Felix Gonzalez Torres. It was the inverse of that. Mm. And people tested every day. We were open. So whilst it wasn't that we were at street level and that, we weren't in a shopping mall or something. That people did want to test in an environment either for novelty's sake or because it had presented itself. So, yeah, I don't know whether that answers it.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the thought that comes to mind as you're describing that aspect of it is, for me, that HIV at this point in the Western world, or, you know, or in the developed world, is you know, has reached so much of the population, and, you know, where you hear about certainly Africa being the most obvious example where it doesn't, that I wonder if, you know, HIV has a bit of a PR problem these days, and if that, and if that's part of your motivation, or if it sounds, I'm going to assume it's more organic than that, but
I would say, yeah. So, I mean, the show grew up out of the name. First of all, I had these three words, Alien Sex Club. I didn't really know what it was. I knew it was a big environment, and slowly it kind of congealed around a critique of the fact that post-minimalism has dominated the way HIV/AIDS has been represented in visual culture, and also that there is an assumption that HIV/AIDS has gone off the table, off the agenda in the West. And actually, HIV rates among gay men in the West have been going up over the past 5-10 years.
Right.
And what are the factors informing that? How could an artwork be used as part of an educational program? And also, how could a different aesthetic reanimate the discussion around the subject?
Okay. So you found this hole in the needle that you could thread with this subject matter and your painting to some extent, among installation and other things.
Yeah, so really it was looking at HIV in a very holistic way, so looking at the social factors that influence it, casual drug use, crystal meth use, which is a very big part of how transmission is occurring at the moment, and also spatial factors, so looking at the spaces of cruising in a digital and an analog sense, so using gay bathhouses, but also looking at apps like Grindr and how mazes are very, and the idea of the cruise maze is an emblematic form that is taken into both realms, and how addiction plays a part, all of these things. So you could, rather than looking at one part of the problem, you were able to join the whole thing together and see it as a world. I mean, you could also come to the show and just enjoy the patterns and the colors and the playfulness of the exhibit. You could choose your entry point in a way.
Right.
So there's also a way of innovating just what I do generally, which is to do with visual access.
You know, I can't help but as misguided and naive as a question or thought as it may be, I can't help but wonder, with that suggestive title of Alien Sex Club, if you know, on nights when the gallery is open late, if it's put to use in any way.
We did wonder. I mean, we don't have any evidence that it was activated as a sexual space.
Right.
It was certainly activated as a social space.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that's a further iteration of the project.
Well, is that, by the way, though, are those kinds of nightclub-based projects something that you've done or are interested in, you know, transferring, you know, the art installation to, you know, the club-type venue?
Not to the club, but I've worked in a lot of spaces that aren't galleries.
Okay.
That are appropriated spaces that become repurposed. And also, I've used the bar and hospitality as a recurring emblem. So
right.
I have turned the gallery into a bar or a club repeatedly.
Right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned maximalism earlier, and, you know, again, we're in audio mode, so it's going to be a bit difficult to translate, but you're definitely a bit of a visual maximalist, and and in fact, and people can see images of your apartment on the site, or they should be able to, and it's quite maximalist itself. Is there something? I'm interested in the what your understanding is of the emotional and psychological ramifications of living, you know, in such a maximalist, in such a colorful environment.
So, alas, I don't live in that apartment anymore. I was there for 5 years. But the new apartment that I show my boyfriend has maximal elements to it. Before I tell you about the emotional ramifications of that, I suppose I should just say that the word maximal is a contested site, just because it has much more traction within music culture than it does within visual art. And nobody's really nailed what it might mean. It's not just the inverse of minimal. It's something more than that that I'm trying to flesh out. But the apartment, it was really about I suppose it's to do with a collapse between life and work in a way.
Mm-hmm.
That the whole thing becomes the project. And that's not necessarily a healthy or an advisable thing, but it's probably something that we're all dealing with. And my feeling was just that it was false to clear the room and put an object in the middle and to have this idea of a white cube, when actually we all go out into the street and it's not like that at all.
Right.
So probably it should be about making objects that have to compete in a much more complex setup. So I suppose my apartment was the test site for that in a way.
Mm. Yeah, I'm just imagining, for example, I mean, to take the most simple example, you're hanging out, you know, alone or with your partner in your apartment, and you've got the orange wall, you know, sort of clouding or dominating your periphery. And what does that do to your psyche over time?
I suppose it feels like the externalization of my head anyway. So it would feel weird if it was white.
Interesting.
It needs to be that color.
Right.
I desire pattern and I desire clashes, very awkward clashes of color. So I'm facilitating something that I feel comfortable with.
So you're
Maybe other people don't. Yeah.
So you're advocating a lifestyle in which the outer world equals the inner world, as opposed to having a sort of minimalist or zen or what have you aesthetic that is a respite from the chaos inside.
Yeah, I don't think that I think that's almost a false dichotomy. I don't think I've been to two very maximal places this year, Japan and Las Vegas, both of which do maximalism in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But Japan's a good example, because even though you have this idea of Zen culture there, really you find respite within the city. It's through people's understanding of the maximal. So you can actually pause within the excess. It's just a different way of thinking about what excess is or something. See what I mean?
Hmm. Yeah, I see what you mean. But I mean, that having been said, I can't get away from the long term. 5 years, right? You were in this Tandoori house, is it?
I called it Tandoori Cottage, which was my imaginary headquarters for my company, my imaginary company, which was called Two Peacocks,
right,
which was actually a show that I curated in the form of a department store.
Mm-hmm.
So there's levels of fiction embedded within it that just reflect how I use humor, I suppose.
Right.
But often these things can grow into real things.
Yeah, yeah. But
I love living in cobalt blue, for example.
Mm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Years ago, I went to Morocco to the Yves Saint Laurent house, Jardin Majorelle, which is this brilliant blue cube in a very red cactus garden. And it makes me feel good.
Sure.
So yeah.
The cobalt blue I can totally get. I almost kind of want to paint my walls cobalt blue right now. But
yeah,
the orange on the other hand, if I remember right, that's a whole nother story.
Yeah, somehow when you're in it, it makes sense. And because all the objects, it's not that it's not unrelaxing.
Mm-hmm.
It's ordered in a different way. It's got a different logic to it.
Right.
So whilst the first impression is of dazzle and chaos and dissonance, it's more harmonious than that. It's just about playing color in a different register. It's like living in a Matisse painting.
Right, right. You mentioned
you already live in a Matisse painting because you live in LA. But if you live in London, you live in a Kossoff painting.
That's an excellent point, because you're talking about the going out into the world of gray, essentially, right? And so it's like, oh, I need my color, and that kind of makes sense, compared to California, right?
And it's kind of a sticking your fingers up and going, I'm determined to wear color and be colorful. And I think it is an expression of an inner state of mind as well.
Yeah. You mentioned the Alien Sex Club being in conjunction with or tied to PhD work, right?
Yeah.
And so just clarify, are you still in the process of getting a PhD, or did you already?
I have just submitted it about a month ago,
mm-hmm.
and I have my Viva my oral exam in about a week's time. So hopefully I'll be a doctor by Christmas.
Wow.
Which is so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all written. I did it in 3 years. It was funded, and it was a great way to, A, bring about this project that I wanted to do, but also really look at it in a different way and embed it within a much broader set of activities that involved writing, ultimately, as well, which was a new thing for me.
Was Alien Sex Club then part one of the aspects of the study or the
So the
work?
PhD is in two parts, and there's a book of writing, which is about 60,000 words, and there's a book of images of the work in Alien Sex Club and the installation. And really, the installation is the test site for gathering responses to the show. So it's not... It's partly about making practice your PhD, but it's partly about how you use... Sorry, I know you hate this word, practice.
Thank you.
But it has... The only way... The reason I use it in this context is because it's distinguished against the writing, and it's also because I did the PhD within the context of architecture. So I am an artist and doing it. So I'm an interloper. So I've had to start to use these words to have meaning within those contexts. I apologize.
No, it's okay. So you're gonna have a PhD in architecture then?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Which
wow.
is very odd.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's odd enough to have be an artist and have a PhD.
Yeah. It kind of fits within the way I've had to diversify what I do over time. And I've increasingly come to see that through the eyes of Cian Nagai. I don't know whether you've read her book, Our Aesthetic Categories.
No, can you give us a brief synopsis?
So basically what she's saying is she's got this idea of zaniness, and it really applies very well to artists because it talks about how we're all flexible labor and we have to diversify what we do all our time and add in new specialisms in order to get by, and we're kind of nomadic jesters, and I'm a perfect example of this.
Right.
And the PhD is just the next string to my bow, in a way.
Right. Is the PhD as in? See, the thing that I'm trying to figure out is for more traditional or for more traditional career arcs, you know, you get the PhD and, you know, if you're working in academia or even in other fields, that's going to give you potentially a higher, you know, salary rate.
Sure.
It doesn't seem like that's relevant in your case.
Well, it weirdly it is. And I think this is partly to do with different cultures in the US and the UK. I was always very scathing of PhD culture and, ridiculed people for doing them until I was absolutely broke and decided that it was a really good way of facilitating this project that I wanted to do anyway. And also then because it paid me and I did it within the 3 years, I feel like I've not made it too much of a fuss. It's not to say it's been easy. I've had to learn a huge amount of new skills that... even though I don't want to be a career academic, one of the things I do is have a foothold in teaching. It does have value there, but also indirectly, it's helped trigger a lot of other things that have value, either in a soft way or in a really genuinely financial way, in terms of applying for grants and my skill there, but also in terms of the opportunities that have opened up for me. So it has changed my career in that sense, yes.
Right. And did you sort of stumble across the program, or was it more like you really had to hunt it down?
A colleague, a friend of mine, presented it to me, and I hadn't thought about it. And then it was like, oh, this could be the way to do it. And wrote the application thinking I won't get a chance, got the interview. There was one paid place that I didn't get, but the person they awarded it to wasn't allowed it in the end for some really technical reason. So I was the second on the list and got it.
Wow.
And then I thought, okay, you've got to do it now. And it's been a really important, great thing, actually. I can't complain at all. It's
yeah.
Fantastic.
How competitive was it? Do you know how many other people were applying?
I don't know. I think they would have interviewed about five people, but it's a very specific thing to do. And also because I was coming as an outsider to architecture,
right,
my chances were slimmer. But the reason it's with architecture is because I'm looking at the spatial properties of cruising and the spaces of cruising,
right,
and trying to flesh out a bit more what they're about. It was also really important that I didn't do it for myself within fine art, because I felt like that was my native place, and
right
it was really interesting to test it within a context that I was an amateur or less familiar with.
So the Alien Sex Club was, you know, the heart of the, or a perfect example, yeah, of how you were analyzing spatial relations and public,
yeah,
and
this
whatnot.
Was my way, yeah, of testing some of my writing,
right,
and introducing those images and motifs and ideas into the work. And the two things really are symbiotic. The making informs the writing, and the writing informs the making.
Mm. Do you have a sense that there's an equivalent in the States? I mean, I can't think of any, yeah, artists in the States who get PhDs other than because they're going to switch over to art history.
There's such a different structure, isn't,
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
I think there are a few practice-based PhDs, but it's not the common thing.
Mm.
No, it's become much more a thing in the UK where people will either go the market route, or they'll go the teaching PhD route.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I'm still straddling lots of different zones, but
right,
the commercial sector wasn't a place where I naturally fell. So
yeah,
I found myself here in a way.
And you've been, as you sort of alluded to, and what I gathered from looking at your work and on your site, that you have been sort of following the meandering path of residencies and grants and that kind of thing, right? That just take you where they will over the country and abroad over here as well.
Yeah, a little bit. Not, I'm definitely not a residency junkie. I've done about four or five residencies,
mm-hmm,
but key points. I mean, to plot my trajectory, leaving grad school in 2003, I was very broke and was signing on for benefits, which you wouldn't have the option of here. But as a UK citizen, I could get my rent paid and get a drip feed of money, even though it wasn't really enough to survive on. It was just a way of stabilizing myself.
Right.
I very soon realized that this was a total trap and that I had to just get a day job. But as much as I can, I've tried not to have a regular job and,
sure,
be self-employed and do bits and bobs, and had a major residency in Rome for 2 years, which is the equivalent of the Rome Prize here, I suppose, which really helped move things ahead for me and allowed me to just get on with my work properly.
Right, right. When you mentioned, because you mentioned earlier about being broke at a certain point, was that period when you got out of grad school and were broke, was that the one you're referring to, or was there another phase of brokenness later?
Oh, there was a much more recent phase.
Yeah, and when was that?
So I chose to apply for this Skowhegan thing and got it and went, and that put my earnings on hold completely.
Mm.
So when I got back from Skowhegan in 2012, I hit total rock bottom financially, and found myself working in a bookshop for a few months.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a real loss of, you know, I had to swallow my pride and,
sure,
just go, okay, you're here. You know, having done all these other things and had these moments, like little highs, things weren't running fluidly, say. And it was at that point that I chose to do the PhD, because I thought, you've got to think strategically about money now. There has to be, you have to get your finances in order first.
Yeah.
Then the other things can come. So,
how many
broke is round the corner.
Right, yeah, absolutely. That's so true. How many hours a week were you working at the bookshop, roughly?
Oh, I was full time for that period.
Oh,
so
okay.
Just on hold, yeah.
And would you say, from your whatever knowledge you have of you know, cross-cultural earnings, that the hourly rate are comparable? I think, just to sort of give you a preface, that I recall that classic sort of independent bookstore rates here were, like, you know, in the $12, $13, $14 an hour range, and I don't know how that translates.
The conversion rate's different than it you know, now than it would be then. But I was probably on like £7.50, £8 an hour. Yeah, it's not a great, it would have been minimum wage plus a tiny bit more.
Right,
It wouldn't have been great.
Yeah, so it's a double swallowing of pride in those two senses. Yeah,
and it was a real wake-up call to make some decisions that weren't just about you need to be in the studio all the time, you know.
Yeah.
I just had to grow up a bit, really.
That's a very contentious, speaking of contentious, that's a very provocative statement, because I mean, it's one that I hopefully a lot of people listening, you know, confront all the time, because if growing up means, you know, getting a full-time job or some equivalent, you know, that's a long-term, not only swallowing of pride, but it's a lifestyle change, you know? So it's a pretty complicated, I just want to say that it's a complicated scenario.
Yeah, I don't know that the growing up is taking the full-time job, but in taking the full-time job, it's a realization that you have to make some other decisions.
Yeah.
Some strategic decisions. If you want to do the work and be the artist,
yeah,
you have to make some canny decisions about how you're going to facilitate this and fund this and survive. And that's what triggered me to apply for the PhD. And that in turn has triggered the grants that I've had from the Wellcome Fund and all these other things,
right,
that led me to where I am now, which is in a much better position.
Sure. We did mention at the beginning that you're in New York, but you live in London, as you have referred to. And I remember seeing that you pretty much moved there right out of undergrad, essentially.
Yeah, so I grew up in Dartford, which is a suburb. I mean, it's not really a suburb. It's a town on the edge of London.
Oh, okay.
It's neither the city nor is it the countryside. It's a non-place. So, I'm not a Londoner, but I'm from the southeast of England.
Right. How far outside of the city is it where you grew up?
It's a 45-minute train ride.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like living in New Jersey somewhere or something. Do you know what I mean? You can get into the city easily, but you're not in the city.
Right. And did you, growing up, did you go into the city much?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as a teenager, that was my excuse to just go up every weekend and see art and escape and see what the world was like beyond the suburbs. Absolutely. Right.
Yeah, yeah. And so all this getting to the questions around surviving in London, because since you've been there, what, like about 20 years now, or 15 to 20, you've seen, you know, as with New York and San Francisco and other places, you know, a tremendous increase in cost of living. And so how, I mean, you can address that however you like, but I mean, I think the first question is, how are you living there now with the rents that we hear about here, you know?
So there's two time frames we can talk. So there's how I'm living there now, and there's how I was living.
Right.
I mean, for a long time, there was the benefits thing that I talked about, but also I took a lot of family money. I mean, I had my parents help out, and that was a shift at a certain point where I had to go, no more. I have to sort this out. And also they said that. And so the situation I'm in now, where I support myself, is partly because my partner and I bought a flat together, and an apartment, and that has allowed our finances to stabilize. And I think that's a key way of surviving. And it's not an option that's necessarily available to everyone. But somehow you have to get out of market rent, either by or leave the big city and go to a small city, which is something that I was considering, going to Liverpool or Manchester or somewhere. But I'd put so much work into making London my home and making it work, and that's where my network of people and opportunities is. Even though I show a lot of outside London, my bread and butter is there. That now I have found ways to source money and keep it going, not just do a project and then stall and panic and have to find the next batch of money. I'm always having to scheme the next thing while one is going on.
Right. I wonder, you know, that takes me back to when you mentioned that you were in Rome for 2 years, you know, because I pictured you as soon as you said that, you know, both working on your, you know, your visual art, painting, installation, et cetera, and at the same time doing a hell of a lot of research, applications to grants, residencies, et cetera, during that time. Is that fair?
I mean, grant writing is such a skill that I've had to learn over time. And it's also a lot to do with knowing who's had these things before you and asking them about it. And yeah, it's also having had a critical number of opportunities that put you on the radar of the people assessing the applications. It's a weird game.
Yeah,
I don't know what to say. What would you like to know?
Yeah, no. I think going back to what you said before, I mentioned the Rome period. You said you figured out, you have figured out how to keep
on one opportunity to the next.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so what are some of the answers in a sort of a general sense, if there are any?
Well, so at the moment, maybe this is a good example of what I'm juggling several projects simultaneously. Mm. I'm teaching a day a week. That's a drip feed of money.
Right.
And that is also where my tax gets paid. Mm. And that's a very practical thing to think about. Mm-hmm. Then I don't have to save as much money from my self-employed earnings to pay my tax at the end of the year. I have a big grant from Wellcome Trust that I pay myself out of. That also pays for materials for the project that I'm working on and pays people to do admin and graphic design and things like this. Mm. I'm also curating a show that has a fee attached to it. I'm doing a little residency in Edinburgh. I mean, it's everything's overlapping.
Right.
And they're all feeding each other and facilitating the next. It's like domino rally. So you have to somehow snatch time to sit and be present. But you can't sit still for too long.
Sure. it does sound, if I might project or speculate or whatever you want to call it does sound that the UK arts and or grant structure is more supporting and more realistic for an artist looking to put together a connected series of survival options than it is here.
It's a completely different beast to the state.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of opportunities that are available to me that you don't have here.
Yeah.
People here have to think about the market.
Right.
There is no way you cannot. I don't have to think about that. I sold some of Alien Sex Club to a museum. Mm-hmm. That was not the main aim of the project. The project could have happened without that.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken me a long time to work out how to leverage the money. There were a lot of failed applications. For every successful one, there's been three or four duds.
Mm.
So it's not that other European countries in the UK give more money to the arts. What has made these applications successful is that they have a critical engagement in things outside of art. So they're to do with other subjects.
Right.
And that's been the success of them.
Yeah. Yeah, do you want to just talk briefly about the current sort of cross-cultural HIV project a bit?
I suppose it's to do with people that are funding things are interested in audiences, and they're interested in how and why this will reach an audience. They want to fund the work if it's good, but it's not just about that for them. So, as an artist, you're working within a much bigger framework of relationships. Now, that's not so different in the US. As an artist, you're making a thing, but the gallery has an agenda. It's always about working in a team. And that's been the big realization is there's different needs that everybody needs to meet. The needs of the institution,
right.
The needs of the funding body. And so CAPSID, which is the project that I'm working on that grew out of Alien Sex Club, looks much more generally at virology and much more specifically at the structures inside viruses. And then what I'm doing is using that information to think about how culture is transmitted. And that goes beyond queer and gay culture, mm-hmm. to think about feminism and think about ethnicity and other things like religion. So you can immediately talk in a very specific way about who might be interested in coming to see this thing.
Mm. Yeah, virology is obviously, depending on the day or the month, a very hot topic. But to what extent do you have to get up to speed on scientific aspects of it, versus sort of big picture things?
Yeah, I like getting to grips with a new subject and immersing myself in it and becoming not an expert, but whatever, an amateur at something, I suppose. And so I will attend lab meetings of the scientific collaborators I'm working with, Towers Lab, which is at UCL in London. And I go and sit in their meetings, and I have a working knowledge of HIV from Alien Sex Club. And I've self-taught through reading books and watching videos and all sorts of things. And so I can grasp certain bits, and then I can build more and more knowledge. I mean, they're talking on an incredibly detailed level about this stuff.
Right.
But within that, there's bits that I can grasp visually as well as verbally, and also structures that they say, verbal structures that I'm like, that's what's that, you know, and that can become a painting or a text in a painting or something. I become an interloper again.
Right. But the question comes to mind is, when you're encountering a meeting, or, you know, sitting in on a meeting and hearing all this foreign language, as it were, it seems that for most artists that would be really dry and kind of hard to follow. And so the question then that comes to mind is it because you're so hungry, you know, because it's so connected to this project that you've been doing, or are you just naturally a, you know, a left and right brain thinker?
It's probably a bit of the latter. I'm really interested in communicating things clearly to myself and to other people. And I don't think all artists are interested in that.
Right.
I'm interested in trying to bring new things into art, new things into the canon, create new zones, you know, saying this is a thing that art can deal with, not just a thing that science can deal with. And so so it's not dry, it's wet. And also it is very difficult to get your head around, but I'm kind of trying to get my head around it so that I can then simplify it for you as the viewer.
Right. Yeah. I'm very supportive of art that brings in, you know, other material. And then I guess the question is, you know, who's your audience in art at that point? You know, how do you go from this really dry place to this wet place? It feels wet to you already, but you got to get it wet for them as well, for the audience.
Yeah. But you get it wet by presenting it differently. I mean, there is an art science aesthetic that has predominated that is really boring, that the nature of what I make isn't, thankfully. It's fun and it's playful, and it uses punning and strange combinations of things, and it also uses non sequitur. So it will also just bring in things that are completely unrelated as a way of conjoining this information onto other subjects. And that might include using pop stars or TV personalities as the anchor for thinking about some weird aspect of virology.
Right.
So you lure people in, really. You seduce them into things that they didn't think they were interested in, that they turn out they are.
Yeah. Yeah, you've described with this project and with your work as well before, and, you know, the way that you've gotten your work supported, as being very sort of, let's see, not, you know, nonprofit, sort of outside the market. Let's just put it that way. And London is known, not too different from New York, as being a pretty market heavy community. And I don't know exactly what my question is, but I wanted to shift into, you know, being in London and how cognizant you are of, you know, the market and either being partially part of it or being apart from it, et cetera.
I'm very conscious of it, and it isn't very different to New York. It's not on quite the same scale.
Right.
It imitates New York. I mean, in a way, LA is doing what London is doing. You're having outposts of New York galleries there.
Yeah.
And it's a way for New York galleries to shift more gear by making the illusion that something different is happening. But actually, it's just a show in New York, really.
Right.
I've worked with galleries before, and it's never really worked out because they can't do for me what they say they will, and I end up doing all the work. And so I don't even though I make stuff, I make objects, I make paintings, and I work prolifically, so there's a lot of gear, that these people haven't found a market for it yet. And I just figured I'm not going to wait around for you to do it. I don't really believe, I don't want to wait for somebody to ordain me. I'll just do it another way.
Yeah.
And so the market will have to come later for
Right.
this.
That's a very, that's an extremely important sentiment for so many artists, because as
Oh,
big as the
yeah.
market is, and you know, always seems to be expanding, it's still not big enough. I mean, it's only,
No.
you know, you see the
And it,
same artists, you know, in the commercial galleries again and again.
I mean, the market is ridiculous, and the market is not going to support the interesting thing. And artists must do things themselves and find ways to fund them, whether that's by having a day job or finding funding, or I mean, you can do it in multiple ways. You can open a bar, you can teach. You just have to find a way of running something yourself and having a say. The market is only one example of that. And it might be the least interesting example.
Yeah, see, that's a really important point, because I think that sentiment was maybe being prompted in my sort of bringing up the topic in the first place and sort of describing, you know, being inside, outside, or what have you. And you know, that's a little bit fuck you for not inviting me in. You know, there's a little bit of that going on. And I, you know, I wonder, you mentioned earlier, I should first go back to when you described, you know, they're not helping me out, or they're not finding a fit. I think you were referring maybe to a particular commercial gallery.
I've worked with three galleries. I worked with a gallery in Bologna when I was in Italy, called Galleria Marabini. I worked with a gallery in Germany called Gallery Ars Pro Toto, and I worked with a gallery in London called Vitrine. And they had all different reasons why it didn't work. But really, I want to be in control of when the work changes and how. And it's not that, I mean, I am a control freak, but that's not the reason why it doesn't work necessarily. But I think a lot of times people want to trade on your relate on your credentials more than their credentials. I also don't want to portray myself as a Marxist. I mean, there is a market. There will always be a market. Somehow things will find a way within the market eventually, but it can't stop you getting on, is what I feel like.
Absolutely. That's well said. I want to go back to your flat in London. This is a bit, you know, a bit out of sequence, but in any case, you and your partner did buy it, and I guess one of the questions that I wondered about was if you can manage to buy a place, if that's more feasible, either sort of in the shorter term or the longer term than renting a market rate place. I mean, in other words, if you buy a place, if you're able to come up with a down payment, is your mortgage going to be significantly lower than, yeah,
It
that,
is.
yeah.
It's significantly lower. It's
Right.
about a quarter the cost. I mean, we
Wow.
had a big deposit, but it has enabled me to rent my studio and not be worrying that I can actually afford to rent a studio. So it's not, I don't want to own property. It's not some big desire to own property. I think we should all be able to rent cheaply. And in the UK, you used to be able to do that until Margaret Thatcher allowed people to buy their council houses, and that took all of this property out of the public realm. But the world we live in at the moment suggests that it is cheaper in the long run not to rent, and that with rent, you're pouring money down the drain. So it's a very pragmatic move on my part to say, okay, let's bite the bullet here and make a long-term decision. And my boyfriend is not an artist. He doesn't have a well-paying job, but he has a steady job. And so between us and the deposit, we have what, the bank said yes,
You were
which amused
surprised?
us. Yeah, really surprised.
And what is the neighborhood that your flat is in comparable to?
So you could call it Bermondsey. We live on Old Kent Road, which is South London, down from Elephant and Castle. It's an area that is beginning to really change very fast, because of gentrification. It's a really nice part of town because it's quite quiet. Over the next 20 years, they're planning to extend the subway down there, so it will change. And it's the side of London that I grew up on. I mean, it's in Zone 1, which is amazing. And it's very well served by buses. You can also walk into central London in 20 minutes, half an hour. So
Wow.
we have a great setup. Yeah.
Yeah. And how far away is your studio?
5 minutes,
Wow.
which is also, I mean, this is a key thing. If you can have your studio really close by, it changes everything because it's preferable not to have the studio at home. I did live work for years, but you never escape the work.
Right.
And actually, you need to have that time away from it.
Yeah.
And also, if you want to have a relationship of any sort, you can't be having that person and the work in the same space.
Yeah, definitely.
But I'm able to get up and either go for a run and then go straight to the studio or go straight to the studio. And if I get in there at 7 a.m., I can have 2 really blissful hours before anyone will even email me,
Right.
which is the ideal.
Yeah. And for those looking for a artist studio in London, what is that a comparable challenge market-wise?
Yeah, it's the from what I've talked about with friends in New York, the rent is similar. It's about £1 a square foot. So, you know, I have a 300 square foot studio. It's not massive. It's also storage. I have a kind of computer area, and then the rest of it is making. I mean, a lot of my work is administrative or making video as well. So,
Right.
it's with a company called ASC Studios, nothing to do with Alien Sex Club, but it always amuses me.
Right.
And they are very well established. They're a little bit above market rent, but I have perks, you know, in terms of electricity and Wi-Fi, things like this. And I don't share my space with anybody else. It's my room,
That's
and
great.
that's really important. But you know, I didn't have a studio for a long, long time. I was a bedroom artist,
Sure.
or I was on a residency,
Right.
and it took me a long time. And you know, I'm not professionalized in certain ways, and then I am in others.
Sure.
So I find it hard to delegate certain things if I don't have an assistant. I've had people help before. I might need more help as things have suddenly got busier. It's just working out how you do all these things and where you put these. Yeah, where
But
you
if
put everything.
yeah. If I could make an analogy though, from the analogy I want to make is being in your house and having your studio in your house to me is a little bit akin to being in your studio and doing your admin or your PhD work in your studio. And I just wonder if that's something that you've been struggling with.
Oh, I mean, I have to switch brains multiple times a day and multiple times a week.
Right.
Yeah, I wear a lot of different hats, and
Right.
it would be great to have a sequence of rooms that
Right.
could each have different functions.
Right.
I mean, that is not possible. That may never be possible, but
Right.
what I tend to do is have to compartmentalize things and go, you are doing PhD work today, or you're writing, or you're doing curating thing. Maybe go out for a walk, or maybe just devote the next day to a different activity and let
Right.
my brain catch up.
Right. But you are describing though the quintessential sort of professional artist lifestyle. You are, you know,
Absolutely.
you're going to the studio and whatever work you're doing work there, which is great. I mean, you don't have to be doing five different places.
No, I mean, that is. It, for a person that lives in a city, whether that's LA, which is even worse because of the travel you have, or New York or London, that the key thing is not to have to go anywhere. I mean, you want to go for a run, but you don't have to actually leave a room because you're wasting time immediately you step out the door. I mean, I've come back to talk to you today from Chelsea, where I had another meeting, and that's taken me an hour. I mean, that's. You can make that time efficient if you read a book, but you're more than likely just going to watch people on the train or something. If I cannot leave SE1, which is my postcode, that's a good day. That's a successful day. But that's not most days. But you know, that's the aim.
Well, one of the things that I talk with your unknown fellow city dweller, Sherman Sam, about, because he's a painter and he also writes about shows. One of the things we talked about is, you know, the decision to go see X show, you know, and whether it's worth it or not. In other words, he
Oh,
described
yeah.
many scenarios in which he went way, way cross town, you know, basically the to see something, you know, and it may have been great, but it may have been a dud, and there's the day, essentially. And I wonder,
absolutely.
Are you somebody who goes and sees shows much?
I increasingly do, but for a long time just went, I'm not interested.
Right.
I mean, I took a real nosedive of caring about other shows and museum shows particularly. But weirdly, in the past year, and I don't know whether this is something to do with the PhD or where my work is at, I've been a bit more inquisitive again and actually enjoyed seeing art. But I don't devote the majority of the week to it.
Sure.
I will, you know, it might be something that I do with my boyfriend on a Saturday.
Right.
We might go and see a couple of things. I don't go to a lot of openings.
Right.
Don't really like them, but if there's somebody I want to see, I might consolidate going to an opening, and that's a good way of, but really what I want to do is go home and watch TV. I mean, I love watching EastEnders and I'm very domestic, so that's
what,
also
nice. Sorry, for us in the States, what's an extender?
So EastEnders is a
oh, EastEnders, I'm sorry.
Sorry, yeah. Which is of a completely different realm to US soap operas. It's very miserable and gritty. Yeah,
right.
I love telly. It's my real relaxation because I can really switch off. I mean, EastEnders is on 4 times a week, and it's been going for like 30 years.
It's a mammoth.
I love what, yeah,
right.
And I love Game of Thrones as well. I'm completely obsessed with that. There's just ways of letting your brain switch off.
I was going to say, does that mean that you are comfortably able to get in touch with the geek part of yourself?
Oh, absolutely. Really
right.
Obsessive. Yeah.
Right, right. I'm really interested, though, in because I and I think a lot of people listening are like you, you know, we really kind of, you kind of have to pull teeth to get us to go to openings. And there's this sentiment that I've shared with people, which is, you know, I'm only going to show if it's somebody I know who's involved,
sure.
Kind of thing. And yeah, I mean, openings are, for a lot of us artists, are just miserable. But then there's this other sort of devil's advocate sentiment, you know, you have to be part of the art world if you want to be in the art world. And, you know, you got to meet people. Otherwise, you know, you're just going to sort of atrophy and so on. You know, do you struggle with those kinds of dichotomies?
Oh, my God, absolutely. I mean, you don't meet people cold usually.
Right.
You know, things are nepotism.
Yeah.
You know. But you sometimes do meet people cold because there's an energy.
Yeah.
And so I've met a couple of, you know, Judith Carlton, who runs Cafe Gallery Projects in Dilston Grove in London,
mm-hmm.
who's a good friend of mine and a colleague. You know, we just met because we kind of got on at a party.
Mm.
Now, that's quite rare.
Right.
And she's an unusual and special person. That I, you know, a lot of my work to do with bars was about railing against openings because I felt like nobody was being nice.
Right.
It was also miserable and dour. And actually what I want is hospitality. I want people to say, hi, John, this is Michael.
Right.
Do you know each other? And be a host. And people at openings are not like that.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you get involved in the art world? At a certain point, the work can speak for itself. You just have to keep trying to get involved in different things. But it mustn't be too forced. You know, you've just got to work with people you get on with.
Right.
I've not got a brilliant way of simplifying it. But earlier on, when you're asking about applications and things, like the critical mass of things that I've got going on at the moment and the reason things are coming towards me for a change, I think is to do with people going, oh, other people are backing you. We want to back you too.
Yes.
That takes you a long, 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 long time
right.
to accrue that amount of stuff. So this isn't a short game is the simple answer.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And that's is very much in play in the opening culture because it's sort of hard to break through that wall, you know, where the in crowd lives basically, and the in crowd in a certain yeah. way, you know, seems to dominate these kinds
yeah.
of occasions. Yeah.
Yeah, I call them phonies. You know, there's people that are in this just for the drinks or
right.
the 3 year whatever dalliance with it, and then there's people who have got a real hunch about something, who are in it for the long haul,
right?
And they have to realize that people maybe don't want to back them immediately, but that shouldn't put them off. They have to work out a way of doing it themselves, and that takes a bit more responsibility, but it's actually better in the long run because you get to have a say and you get to make some decisions.
Yeah. I assume you've gone to at least one or a few openings in New York at some point. I'm just wondering how you compare them to London. Is it pretty similar? Is it quite a bit different?
It's a bit more of a hullabaloo in Chelsea. I mean, those nights in Chelsea when a lot of things open at once, it's kind of crazy, isn't
it? Oh, God.
Yeah, I mean, I find it completely disconcerting.
Right. Well said. Yeah, good word. There's this comedian whose podcast I listen to. He tailors his podcast to being more of an opportunity to get away from his sort of stand-up act. But he has spent a lot of time in London, and one of the things that he jokes about from time to time is how sort of formal and standoffish the culture is, like, particularly in shops. Like, if you get friendly, you know, the shopkeeper is gonna, you know, look at you like you're fucking crazy. Is that a fair assessment from your experience?
Well, I think that there's just the signifiers are different in our cultures,
right?
And even though we share a language, they're not manifest in the same way. English people are playful in a different way than Americans, and they're often very rude. And
right.
American people don't. And that's a playful thing as well. I mean, sarcasm is a dominant force.
Yeah,
I don't know. It depends who you meet. Yeah, a lot of English people are really up for the banter and the chat. But then a lot of people do a kind of politeness that will close everything down, particularly if you're American, maybe. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, got it. Well, John, do you think is there anything you feel like we've left untapped for the moment?
I don't know. I think we've covered loads of things.
We have indeed, yeah. Well, it's been great. It's been great talking to you, John. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed it.
Absolutely. And we're out. Thanks so much again to John Walter for talking to me. I hope you enjoyed that. Dr. John, hope you are well in London. And thank you to Emily Colucci for making the thoughtful introduction to John, Emily in New York. And I thought John might be good to talk to, and indeed she was right. Go listen to Emily's episode if you haven't already. Thank you guys very much for listening. Before we go, make it real quick. I know that 'tis the season to donate to the ACLU, Planned Parenthood, other important nonprofits at this juncture. There's still room for entertainment / culture in your life, though, and that's where the conversation guides you and feeds you every week. So I really appreciate your continued donations, especially if you have not donated to the show yet. The little pre-intro fundraiser from the second half of Matt Gleason was not effective, but hoping on this time on the back end that I will cajole some of you to perhaps donate some of your remaining cash after the important nonprofit donations that you've made to the conversation. As little as $10 is appreciated, although if you can make it 20 or more, I will put you on the head of the table list for, first of all, the first bonus episode, that is with Max Maslansky, stuff we could not share in the main episode with Max. And I am about to send out bonus episode number 2, which is an outtake with last episode's guest, the notorious Matt Gleason, where he sings Lou Rawls. He excoriates his alma mater, that is Cal State LA. It's just a nice little inside peek of our chat sort of between moments of recording. So I would love for you guys to listen to that. I would love for you guys to donate to the show. You can, of course, also support the show by becoming a fan on Facebook, following the show at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. And, of course, it would be very much appreciated as well if you could leave a great review on iTunes, which is linked through the website, or if you are on iTunes, you can just type in The Conversation, An Artist Podcast, and you will find it. And then you will leave that great review, and we will appreciate it because it'll bring more people to the show. All right. Thank you so much. Of course, spreading the word is always appreciated as well. I hope you guys are having a nice Thanksgiving holiday or other holiday period. And I look forward to talking to you more next week. Ciao for now.